Good morning, everybody. Today I want to talk about a subject which I'm pretty sure you have never heard discussed in this forum or in any other forum. What are you all doing here? What do you mean, what are we doing here? We've come here to hear words of Torah, and I have some women who are actually davening here. No, that's not what I mean. I mean, why do you want to hear words of Torah? Why are you davening? Well, we're davening because that's what it says in Mishul Hadar. That's what it says in our Halacha. No, you haven't understood me. Why do you feel that you should do what the Halacha says? Why do you feel that the Torah obligates you? Why do you feel that the Torah is a book of divine origin given to Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai? What is the basis for your belief? What are you all doing here this morning? Well, I don't know about you. I'm telling you about myself. I come from a frum family. I'm not a Baal Shuva. I've been keeping mitzvahs all my life. I'm frum. My brothers are frum. My parents are frum. Grandparents, and my whole family has been frum all the time. That's what we do. We keep Torah and mitzvot. And why do we do it? Well, that's what we've been doing. That's the family tradition. Is that all we have to say? We keep Torah and mitzvot because it's a family tradition? What if I'd been born into a Christian family? Would I be in church this morning praying to Jesus? What if I'd been born into a Muslim family? Would I have gone to the mosque on Friday and prayed to Allah? What if I would have born to some family in Central? Point. I should use the mic. You can't hear me? Can you hear me now? What if I'd been born to a family in Central Africa? Who knows what I would be doing this morning? Is all I can say about my religion, it's some sort of a family tradition to believe in Matan Torah, a historical event which happened thousands of years ago for which there is no historical evidence whatsoever. Is that what my whole life is based on? A family tradition? This question has haunted me for many years. It haunts me today. It'll probably continue to haunt me for the rest of my life. But maybe there is something one can say. Maybe there is some rational basis for everything that we devote our lives to. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. You see, in addition to being a religious Jew, I'm also a scientist. And scientists also have their beliefs. Their beliefs are called theories. And I want to explore with you how scientists come to their beliefs. And maybe from that, we can learn something about a rational basis for our beliefs. Well, how does science work? Well, if you've ever gone to high school, you've probably heard of something called the scientific method. Complete fiction, unrelated to reality. What does the scientific method say? It says that science is based on facts. Experimental facts, observational facts, and the strength of this is everyone, you can repeat these experiments. Everyone can do it. You can do an experiment in New York, and a scientist can do the same experiment in London, and in Jerusalem, and in the North Pole, and the South Pole, they all get the same results, or the same observation. They all get the same results. This is the bedrock of science. Experiments are reproducible. Experiments are available to everybody. And science is based on this assembly of facts. And after you have a bunch of facts on a subject, then you try to think about some conceptual framework, some theory which might explain these facts. And then you have a theory, you perhaps perform other experiments to confirm the theory, and maybe you have to modify it, maybe the experiment showed the theory is wrong. And that's the way science works. The essence, the bedrock of science is facts. This description is completely removed from reality. That is not at all the way science works. Now I'm going to tell you, I'm a scientist, now I'm going to tell you how science really works. Science is based on theories, on concepts. an idea. That's the bedrock of science. And after an idea is proposed, one examines whether the idea is consistent with our observation, with our experiments. Maybe it has to be modified, maybe it has to be rejected, but the bedrock of science is theory. Let me give you an example. The standard theory of cosmology, theory, the branch of science that deals with the origin of the universe, is called the Big Bang Theory. The theory postulates that there was an event, a one-time event which occurred in the distant past. It'll never be repeated. Nobody can reproduce this in the laboratory. The energies we acquired are so enormous, never were we able to reproduce this event. But every scientist believes in the Big Bang. Does it sound like Matan Torah, a one-time event in the distant past? But all scientists believe in the Big Bang theory. It is taught in every university. The founders of this theory were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. All my examples will be physics because I'm a physicist. Why is that? Why do all the scientists believe in a theory whose fundamental idea can never be tested, can never be reproduced, and it's a one-time process? Why do they all believe in the Big Bang theory? And the answer is the following. Because if the Big Bang really occurred in the distant past, there are implications that you can test today. There are predictions of the theory which you can test today. The Big Bang theory predicts A. We can go into the laboratory and measure, and we find A happens. A is confirmed. The Big Bang theory predicts B. We can go into the laboratory and make measurements, and B is confirmed. And the Big Bang theory predicts C, D, E, F, G. And every single prediction of the Big Bang theory has been confirmed. So therefore, scientists say, well, the most plausible explanation, why do you observe today A and B and C and D, E, F? Because there really was a Big Bang which occurred in the distant past that nobody can reproduce today. This is called a plausibility argument. The most plausible reason that you can observe alter prediction is that the Big Bang really occurred. So therefore, all scientists believe in the Big Bang. It has come to be known as the standard theory of cosmology. It is taught in every university. Take another example. There's a very small fundamental particle called a quark. You may or may not have heard of quarks. It doesn't matter. This is not some exotic particle. This is the basis of modern theoretical physics. The entire structure of modern theoretical physics is based on the theory of quarks. It is accepted by every scientist. Those who proposed it were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. So you can imagine that scientists have seen quarks. I don't mean seen with their eyes, with their instruments. They can isolate quarks, they can measure their charge, they can measure their mass, they can put them into electric fields, magnetic fields, and see how they behave, like we do with electrons. And the answer is no. My friends, nobody has ever seen a quark. Not only has nobody ever seen a quark, according to quark theory, it is impossible to observe an isolated quark. Well, I don't understand. If nobody has ever seen a quark, and nobody expects to see it, why do all scientists believe in quarks? Why does the main theory of modern physics based on quark theories when nobody has ever seen a quark? And the answer is that if the quarks really exist, there are predictions to quark theory. If quarks really exist, we should observe Aleph. And you go into the laboratory and you observe Aleph. And if quarks really exist, you should observe Bet. And you go into the laboratory and you can measure Bet. And quarks theory predicts Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin. And every single prediction of quarks theory has been confirmed. So therefore, the most plausible explanation, why do we see Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin, and the most pleasant is because there really are quarks. And therefore, all scientists believe in the existence of quarks, and it has become the basis of the structure of modern theoretical physics. Plausibility arguments. That's how science works, okay? Now that we know how science works, let's apply these ideas to the Torah. The fundamental belief in our religion is that there was an event in the distant past called Matan Torah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave this book of divine origin, the Torah, to Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Torah tells us how we are supposed to lead our lives. No one is alive today who could possibly have witnessed this. There's no historical evidence for it. How do we proceed? We proceed the same way as science does. Just like the theory of Big Bang and the theory of quarks, the Torah makes predictions. That is, the Torah makes statements. And these statements can be examined today. Now, what we're looking for is not these generalized statements that Israel is the land of milk and honey, so is Switzerland, so is New Zealand. We're going to look at the psukim which are counterintuitive, which seem impossible, which seem crazy, which seem mythological. Those are the psukim that we are going to examine and see whether these crazy sounding psukim have a basis in reality. Let's start. The most dramatic pasuk in the whole Torah is the very first pasuk. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-eretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, the cosmos, the universe. The Torah tells us that the universe began through an act of creation. Creation? No, for a long time. Creation is impossible. You can't create something from nothing. Impossible, but there's been a reassessment. And nowadays, the standard theory of cosmology, as I mentioned, is called the Big Bang Theory, supported by a vast array of scientific evidence, accepted by every cosmologist, taught in every university, awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, and the central theme of the Big Bang Theory is that the universe began through an act of creation. I repeat, the universe began through an act of creation. And it is interesting and instructive to quote some of the world's leading authorities on the subject of creation. We begin with Professor Paul Dirac. Paul Dirac is a Nobel Prize winner from the University of Cambridge and one of the towering giants of 20th century physics, on a level of Einstein mamash. Professor Dirac writes, quote, "It seems certain that there was a definite time of creation. Not it is likely, it is probable, it is certain that there was a definite time of creation." We now go to Professor Alan Guth, America's leading cosmologist. Professor Guth writes, quote, "The instant of creation remains unexplained." We now go to Professor Joseph Silk, another important cosmologist from the University of California. Professor Silk wrote a book recently about the Big Bang, entitled The Big Bang. He has no imagination in choosing titles for his books. The very first sentence of Professor Silk's book is the following, quote, "The Big Bang is the modern version of creation." And finally, we come to Professor Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist with a capital C, the superstar of the University of Cambridge. Professor Hawking writes, "The creation lies outside the scope of the known laws of physics." Today, every scientist speaks of the creation of the universe and uses the word creation, bria, to describe what happened. Because today, every scientist can take appropriate instrumentation, carry out appropriate measurements, and thereby obtain clear and unequivocal scientific proof that the universe began through an act of creation. Creation of the universe is no longer an article of faith. The rabbis can retire. The creation of the universe is no longer some sort of theological hypothesis. The creation of the universe has become a scientifically established fact, exactly as the Torah tells us. And what do all these scientists mean when they speak of creation? Creation of what? What object was created to begin the universe? And the scientists refer to creation to the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. Scientists call this the primeval light bulb, but it has a popular name, the Big Bang, and hence the name of the theory. And that answers another question. What do we read in the Torah? We read on the first day of creation. We read, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or, Vayhi Or. And God said, well, let there be light. And there was light. On the first day of creation, when there was no sun, and no stars, and no moon, and no light bulbs, and no matches, and no people, and no source of light. Anybody ever heard of them? The Torah tells us, let there be light. And there was light. And for 3,000 years, nobody knew what these words meant. Well, maybe spiritual light or something. It can't be physical light, because there was no physical light on the first day. And now the scientists tell us, yes, there was physical light on the first day. That's the way the universe began. Let there be light. Exactly what the Torah tells us has been confirmed by modern science. That is, the Torah does not report two creations on the first day of creation. The creation of the universe and the creation of light. But the creation of the light was the creation of the universe. Exactly as the Torah tells us. Second day of creation. Second day of creation discusses the Rakia, the Shemayim, the heavens. What a scientist would call outer space. And what do we read? We read about the function of the heavens. Vayavdeya ben amayim ashem mitachet l'rakia, uvein amayim ashem me'al l'rakia. And God separated from the waters below the heavens from the waters above the heavens. Waters below the heavens, I understand. Oceans, rivers, lakes, the Hudson, the East River, the Kinneret, water from the tap, regular water, but ribono shel olam. What possible meaning could there be to the expression waters above the heavens? Has anyone ever heard of large bodies of water floating about in outer space? It sounds completely irrational. Therefore, my friends, I am happy to be able to announce that the scientists have discovered the waters above the heavens. At the edge of the solar system, there's enormous quantities of water. Ice really is cold up there. Much more water than there is down here. If all this ice could be brought down to Earth and melted, it would fill the ocean basins 1,000 times. The waters above the heavens have become a scientifically established fact. And so it goes to the third day and the fourth day and the fifth day, all 6 days of creation. All these mythological sounding and irrational and crazy and impossible sounding pasukim, every single one has been confirmed by man. I wrote a whole book about this. I devote one chapter of my book to each of the 6 days of creation. And I showed that every pasuk in the Torah, every biblical word and phrase has its counterpart in the realm of science. Today the scientists are telling us exactly what the Torah tells us in astronomy and geology and biology and archaeology. In fact, the scientists sometimes use the same terminology as the Torah without knowing that, of course, they don't care what the Torah says. The correspondence between Torah and science is almost too good to be true. To summarize, at least regarding the first chapter of Sefer Bereishit, the era of contradictions between Torah and science is over. So what else does the Torah tell us that we can check? What other crazy, impossible statements do we find in the Torah? Well, in Sefer Devarim, we find that Bnei Yisrael is described as Am Chacham V'Navon. We are a wise and clever people. That is, take it literally. We're not like the Frenchmen and the Chinese. We're smarter than they are. We're smarter than anybody else on this planet. Well, there's a politically incorrect statement if I ever heard it. But I don't care about that. I want to know, is it true? Well, if you ask a scientist, what's a clever, smart person, they'll tell you, it's somebody who won the Nobel Prize. Alfred Nobel amassed a fortune in his life, and he devoted his fortune to establishing a fund that the interest of this fund would go to giving 5 prizes, which are known as the Nobel Prizes. The 3 are in science. I'm not talking about the prize in literature or the prize in peace. That's all politics. Yasser Arafat, Nobel Peace Prize. I mean the prizes in science. There's a prize in physics, there's a prize in chemistry, and there's a prize in physiology medicine. The Nobel Prizes have become the ultimate tribute of a brilliant scientist of important contributions. There's no greater award in the realm of science than for scientists to win the Nobel Prize. In each of these 3 areas, physics, chemistry, up to 3 scientists can be awarded the prize in any given year. The Nobel Prizes have been awarded for over 100 years, so we have lots of data. Over 600 scientists have won Nobel Prizes in science. So now we can ask, what proportion of the Nobel Prize winners in science are Jewish? Hang on to your shifles, my friends. The answer is 23%. Maybe you can argue, who is a Jew? 20% glatt kosher. The Jews form less than 1% of the, I don't mean the population of the world, I mean where they, not Central Africa, Asia, where they do science. Western Hemisphere, Europe, Pacific Rim, where there are universities of research and do science, we are less than 1% of the population. And we have won not 1% of the Nobel Prizes, not 2, not 5, not 10, 23%. Am Chacham V'Novon. This year, just a few weeks ago, the Nobel Prizes are always awarded on December 10th. That's the anniversary of Nobel's death. He wrote that in his will. The prizes are to be awarded on his yard site. 3 weeks ago, there were 7 winners this year in physics, chemistry, physiology, medicine. One was even an Israeli. And how many of these 7 were Jewish? 4! If you're schwach in arithmetic, that's 57% of this year's Nobel Prize winners were Jewish. Am Chacham V'Novon. And not just pure science, what about technology? Well, the Wall Street Journal, not known for its pro-Zionistic tendencies, gives awards in technological innovation every few years. In the last award, they give 3 prizes when they make the awards. The last time, 2 of the 3 winners were Israeli start-up companies. Yes, we let one Goyish company win, so it shouldn't look like we're discriminating. And not just in science. Take something far removed from science. Take music. Who are the great violinists in this history? There's Isaac Stern and Yehuda Menuhin and Yitzhak Perlman and Yasha Heifetz and Nathan Milstein and Pinchas Zuckerman, and who are the great pianists? There's Vladimir Horowitz and Arthur Rubinstein and Daniel Birnbaum. We are 1% of the population. And we excel in every single area, which requires creativity and spirituality and intelligence and something new. The Jews stands at the forefront. The iconic figures in science, there's Albert Einstein. In psychology, it's Freud. In economics, it's Karl Marx. If you don't like Marx, there's Milton Friedman and Paul Samuelson. We are the world's recognized leaders. Chacham V'Novon. The goyim who hate us call us everything. We're cheaters and we're crooks and we run the world and we persecute everybody and we kill Christian children to use their blood to bake our matches. But no anti-Semite ever called the Jews stupid. We are universally recognized as an Am Chacham V'Novon. Exactly what the Torah tells us. But don't say this outside, it's politically incorrect. What else does the Torah say that we can check? The Torah tells us in the void, Because of our iniquities, we will be driven from the land of Israel. And it happened. Well, it's not so surprising. Many countries were driven from their homeland. However, the Torah tells us that in the fullness of time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will have mercy on our people and will restore us to our homeland. ושב אלינו אלוהיך ואת שבותך ורחמך, ושב וקיבצך מן העמים אשר הפיצך אלינו אלוהיך שמה, אם יהיה נידחך בקצה השמיים, משם יקבצך אלינו אלוהיך, ומשם יקחך, והביאך אלינו אלוהיך על הארץ, אשר ישוע בותך וירשתה, והטיבך והרבך מאבותך. We will be restored to our land. And my friends, in our lifetime, it has happened. A unique event in history. There is no other example of a people driven from their land and dispersed throughout the nations and over to 1,000 years later came back to reestablish themselves. But we have done it. We have reestablished the state of Israel. We have developed a thriving Jewish democracy. We have made the desert bloom. We have an economy which is the envy of the Western world. We have an army which is the most powerful in the Middle East. We have become the startup capital of the world. Exactly what the Torah tells us. And there is no other example of this in history. The Romans who live in Rome today have nothing to do with the Romans of the ancient Roman Empire. They have a different language and a different religion and a different culture, and they are not the descendants of the ancient Romans. They happen to be sitting on the same real estate. There is no connection. And the same is true of the Greeks in Athens and the Persians and the Egyptians. There is no connection between the modern inhabitants of this country and the ancient empires. But we have the same religion. And we in Israel have the same language. And we have the same culture. And we are the descendants of the ancient Israelites. Just like the Torah tells us. We have reestablished the Jewish Commonwealth. A unique event in history. Exactly what the Torah tells us will happen, and in our lifetime, it has happened. What else does the Torah tell us? It sounds a little crazy, but we can check. Well, the Torah tells us that the world is not an arbitrary place. It is not a random entity which has no purpose. The Torah tells us that the world has a purpose, that God created the Torah for a particular reason. And that reason is human beings. We are, man is Nezer HaBriah, we are the pinnacle of creation, that the whole purpose of God's creating the universe was that human beings should exist, human beings should be able to flourish in this world. The Torah tells us, it hints us in Sefer Bereishit, God tells us, Adam, all of this is for you, we chose Noah, all of this is for you, and it's developed further. In the Talmud, in our sources, the whole world has one purpose, and that's mankind. Well, that sounds pretty strange. The whole world is for mankind? Is there any evidence to support this idea? If you ask a scientist, a Goyisha atheistic scientist, does he see any signs in this universe that look as if the universe was created specifically for man? And the remarkable answer to this question is yes. Yes. In the last 30, 40, 50 years, scientists have discovered an enormous number of features of this universe which make it look as if it were specifically designed for human beings. Well, of course, atheistic scientists, it's just some sort of crazy accident. It doesn't mean anything, but it certainly looks this way. Now, I don't have time to tell you exactly what these features are. I have a whole chapter of this in my book. But let me quote you what the scientists say about this. And I want to repeat, these are all atheistic scientists. I got to say this because what they say sounds like your local rabbi. We'll start with Professor Freeman Dyson. Professor Dyson was the most was the most important mathematical physicist of the 20th century. Professor Dyson is a professor of the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton. If you haven't heard of this research institute, that's where Albert Einstein was a professor many years. Not a place for schmendrikin. Professor Dyson writes the following, and I quote, "As we look out into the universe and identify the many features of physics and astronomy that have worked together for our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must have known that we were coming. It almost seems as if the universe must have known that we were coming." So writes a world-famous scientist, completely atheistic, describing the universe as he sees it. Well, that's the physical sciences. What about the biological sciences? Well, in the biological sciences, the most dramatic event which ever occurred was the transformation from inanimate material to living cells, the origin of life. And what the scientists have to say about the origin of life? Well, this is a branch of science called molecular biology. It's been around 60 years, there's been tremendous progress. They discovered, for example, that the molecule of life, DNA, parts of DNA are the genes, and genes determine what the creature will be. And the question is, how did life begin? And on this subject, I wish to quote Professor Francis Crick. Francis Crick is a world expert on the origin of life. He received his Nobel Prize, this double helix of DNA. That's Francis Crick. And Francis Crick is a militant atheist. Why do I say that? You'll hear the quote and you'll know why. Professor Crick writes, quote, "The origin of life appears to be almost a miracle." Almost a miracle. So many other conditions which would have had to be satisfied to get life going. It doesn't mean a miracle in the theological sense. The man is an atheist. It means a miracle like Israel should win 10 gold medals in the next Olympics. That if this world famous scientist, a man totally devoid of any shred of religious feeling, should use the words almost a miracle to describe the conditions necessary for life to begin, you can imagine that these conditions must have been very, very special. Super special. Super duper special. Super duper glooper special. And somehow, these almost a miracle conditions happen to be satisfied. And life began. Aren't we lucky? Well, that's life in general. But as I said, the purpose of creation is not to come to life in general. God did not create the universe for the kangaroo and the crocodile and the cockroach. He created the universe for us, for human beings. And are there any features of this world which make it look like it is specifically designed for human beings? And the answer, as you could have guessed by now, is yes. And on this subject, I want to quote Professor Stephen Jay Gould. He's Jewish, but don't worry, a total atheist. Professor Gould is a world-famous evolutionary biologist from Harvard University. Fortunately, he died of cancer a few years ago. And Professor Gould wrote a book on this subject. And in the book, he writes the following. Let the tape of, he imagines the development of the animal kingdom as a videotape. Let the tape of life play again from the identical starting point, and the chance is vanishingly small that anything like human intelligence would grace the replay. And why is the chance vanishingly small? Professor Gould tells us that we are an improbable and fragile entity. Human beings are the result of a staggeringly improbable series of events. Not an improbable series of events, a staggeringly improbable series of events. Utterly unrepeatable and quite unpredictable. He has a 320-page book explaining what these events are to get the human beings A had to happen, and B had to happen, and C had to happen, and D, and all these things just happened to happen. Aren't we lucky? And what is Professor Gould's explanation for the staggeringly improbable series of events which is necessary to lead to human beings and just happen to happen? And Professor Gould tells us it's luck. Well, maybe he's right. Maybe it is just luck. But maybe it isn't just luck. Maybe there's a guiding hand behind these staggeringly improbable series of events. If you are looking for the fingerprints of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the development of our universe, there is no better place to look than the staggeringly improbable series of events, which was necessary to lead to human beings and just happened to occur. Professor Gould writes later, it fills us with amazement because of the improbability of the event that human beings exist at all. Like the distinguished professor from Harvard, I too am filled with amazement that human beings exist at all. Professor Gould speaks of luck. I think maybe we have another explanation for these staggeringly improbable series of events. And there are many other features of the Torah. I can't tell you everything in a single lecture. I have a whole chapter on this in my book. Features of the world which seem improbable and crazy. The Torah tells us that's what will happen. And all these things happen. Just like the Torah tells us. No, my time is coming to an end. It's time to summarize. I passionately believe in the Big Bang Theory, and I passionately believe in the theory of quarks, even though not I and not anybody has witnessed the Big Bang, not anybody has ever seen a quark. And I believe in these theories, and all scientists believe in these theories, because all the predictions of the Big Bang Theory have been confirmed. All the predictions of quark theory have been confirmed. And as a Jew, I passionately believe in the truth of Torah Min HaShemayim, that Matan Torah was an event which actually occurred. And the Jews received from HaKadosh Baruch Hu the Torah, according to which we are supposed to run our lives. And to support my belief, I have this enormous number of predictions in the Torah, none of which sound rational, none of which sound possible, and every single one of these predictions has now been confirmed. Therefore, my friends, it is perfectly rational for you to be sitting here, to come here, and to learn Torah. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We have a moment or two for questions. Yes, but please speak loudly. I'm half deaf. No propaganda, just say. Their chronology. Well, I have chapter 2. in my book, The Age of the Universe. It's all here. I can't answer. This is a good question. I have a principle. Good questions do not have short answers. A sentence or two, hop, lop, to get rid of this important question. That's not my style. Whole chapter in it. If you knew what the Rambam wrote, right? Moe Nebuchim, Chelek Bet, Part 2, Chapter 25, what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Sadizai, Lomen Aleph, and other Torah sources, you'll see there's no contradiction at all between the true Torah tradition and what scientists say about the time scale, but I can't do everything in a single lecture. In three words, not to worry, it's all right. Chapter 2. Yes? Yeah, what's the question?
It's not a question.
Oh.
The proof is that the world was created for man is in charge of the world.
That man is in charge of the world is an established fact. Right, that is correct. Okay, fine. That could be another indication that the Torah says, and that's what happened. Okay. Yes? Evolution. It would not take me 20 moments to give it proper answer to your question. It would take me 45 of a whole lecture on the subject about evolution. It is can't possibly summarize it in a couple of sentences, but in my book, The Fifth Day, Part 1, Evolution, you wouldn't believe what the scientists have recently discovered about evolution. There's a whole new paradigm. Everything fits. Thing fits wonderful. Evolution has become good for the Jews, but how and why and what's happened? Fifth day of creation, part one. These are all good and important questions, but I just can't speak for 10 hours. I have another lecture to give in 15 minutes to the men. So I can't. These are important questions, and I've written about them, and it's good that you ask them, but I can't explain everything in a single lecture. But there's a good answer to your question. Okay, thank you very much. Oh, wait, yes. Yeah. I can't hear you. I am not ashamed to admit that there are many things in the Torah that I cannot explain. Of course, I speak about what I can explain and not what I cannot explain. The flood, for example, I cannot explain the flood. There are other things. This is not a problem that we have a question. There's a saying, nobody ever died from a question. What I don't understand today, maybe tomorrow, if not tomorrow, maybe next year. I don't view questions as a source of the oppression. I view questions as a challenge for further research and further study. We understand so much today. I have every reason to be optimistic that we will be able to understand the questions which are still open in science. I don't understand everything. I'd be fired if the research would come to an end if we understood everything. There's research in Torah, research in science. Yes, there are things I don't understand, but every year we understand more and more. Nothing wrong with that. Okay, thank you very much.